is VOA News via remote. I'm Laura Berman. Parents converged on a secondary school in Nigeria's northwestern Katsina state on Sunday, begging authorities to find hundreds of schoolboys missing or abducted by gunmen. The army had exchanged fire with a gang that reportedly took hundreds of students from the all-boys government science school in Kankara, a spokesman for the president said on Saturday night. But some parents on Sunday said they had heard little more on the fate of their children. Some boys, seen by Reuters News, said they had escaped from the forest where the gunmen took them, but it was not immediately clear how many remained in captivity or what the kidnappers wanted. A state governor who visited the school said that soldiers were in the bushes fighting the attackers, and it's not clear how many boys were still in their hands and how many had escaped. Attacks by armed gangs are common throughout northwestern Nigeria. The groups typically attack civilians, stealing or kidnapping them for ransom. Islamist militants who attack security and civilian targets are more common in the northeastern part of the country. A popular Indonesian Muslim cleric was arrested Sunday for allegedly breaching coronavirus restrictions after he held a series of sermons with tens of thousands of followers. Rizieq Shihab's arrest came just days after Jakarta police shot dead six followers of his hardline Islamist group in a highway shootout. Police said that the cleric will be detained for 20 days to prevent him from fleeing and destroying evidence, as well as repeating offenses. Shihab was welcomed by tens of thousands of followers at Jakarta Airport on his return from exile last month in violation of a COVID-19 ban on gatherings. Dozens who attended him later tested positive for the coronavirus. Indonesia has reported more than 600,000 coronavirus infections and over 18,000 deaths. This is VOA News. Sudan's premier said Sunday he had agreed with his counterpart in Ethiopia's capital to hold an urgent meeting of a bloc of East African countries to resolve the crisis in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Ethiopia did not immediately confirm Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok's announcement of an emergency meeting of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development. Hamdok traveled to Addis Ababa on Sunday to discuss the Tigray conflict with his counterpart, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. He was the first foreign leader to visit the Ethiopian capital since fighting broke out in the region on November 4th, creating a humanitarian crisis. Thousands have been killed since the start of the conflict in Tigray, according to the International Crisis Group, and just over 50,000 people have fled to neighboring Sudan since Abiy ordered troops into the region to confront its dissident ruling party. Iran's foreign ministry Sunday summoned Germany and France's envoys to protest EU condemnation of the execution of an opposition figure, describing it as an unacceptable interference in Tehran's affairs, state media reported. Rohola Zam was hanged on Saturday after Iran's Supreme Court upheld his death sentence passed in June over his role in protests during the winter of 2017-2018, among other charges. The EU, in a statement on Saturday, condemned the execution in the strongest terms and emphasized its opposition to the use of capital punishment. The Iranian Foreign Ministry's Europe director, in turn, told Germany's ambassador that Tehran condemned the statement, which it deemed an unacceptable interference in Iran's domestic affairs, a state news agency said. Germany currently holds the European Union's rotating presidency. A state news agency reported later Sunday that the foreign ministry also summoned France's ambassador to Tehran following the interventionist statement by the French foreign ministry. Zam was granted political asylum in France and reportedly lived in Paris before his arrest last year by Iran's Revolutionary Guards, who claimed he had been directed by France's intelligence service. France's foreign ministry had decried Zam's hanging, calling it an unacceptable and barbaric act. Tens of thousands of Indian farmers on Sunday intensified their protests against three new agricultural laws aimed at overhauling food grain procurement and pricing rules by allowing private companies direct access to the vast agrarian sector. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America on this Latin American edition of the program. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro gains control of the National Assembly after holding elections widely viewed as fraudulent. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The United States and many other democracies around the world, including in Europe and Latin America, have rejected the conduct and the outcome of the December 6th legislative elections. The National Assembly was the last branch of the Venezuelan government controlled by the U.S.-backed opposition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in a statement that, quote, Maduro brazenly rigged these elections in his favor through the illegal seizure of political parties' names and ballot logos, manipulation of the process by his loyalist electoral council, violence and intimidation, and other undemocratic tactics. He went on to say that the United States condemns this charade, which failed to meet any minimum standard of credibility. The Maduro regime rejects the charges of fraud. The VOA newsroom reports that pro-Maduro candidates received 60% of votes cast. This is according to Venezuela's National Electoral Council, with voter participation at just more than 30%. As in recent Venezuelan elections, there were no international monitors. The opposition boycotted the elections, which they considered a sham, in contrast to the 2015 contest when Venezuelans gave the opposition control of two-thirds of the National Assembly. The United States is one of 50 countries that does not recognize Maduro as Venezuela's legitimate leader. Washington, along with a consortium of European and Latin American democracies, support National Assembly President Juan Guaido, who claimed victory in the January 2019 presidential elections, but has not assumed office. Reuters quotes Colombian President Iván Duque as saying that the recent elections were a bid by Maduro to seize control of the body, the last bastion of opposition power. Analysts say the international community could play a decisive role in the wake of Maduro's actions. Nations will have to decide whether and how to uphold the legitimacy of the Venezuelan interim government, which derives its legality from the current National Assembly led by Juan Guaido. Regional observers argue that democracies will have to find a way to hold the authoritarian regime of Nicolas Maduro accountable and to do so in a unified manner to eventually facilitate a peaceful transfer of power. Well, with us to examine the ramifications of the Venezuelan elections, as well as the challenges facing the incoming Biden administration, are two distinguished Latin America analysts. Eric Farnsworth is vice president of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society. That's an organization known as a leading voice on Western Hemisphere affairs based here in Washington. And Ryan Berg, he's research fellow specializing in Latin America at the American Enterprise Institute. And that's a policy group based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
Thanks for having me, Carol.
You bet. Eric Farnsworth, let me start with you. I think aside from maybe Cuba, Russia, Iran, possibly China, it's fairly universally accepted that these legislative elections, you know, which give the Maduro regime control over all levers of power, were fraudulent. And of course, the opposition did boycott them, because the rules were rigged against them. The question is, now what? You know, what options does the community of democracies have to thwart this so-called fait accompli by Maduro?
Thanks, Carol. It's great to join you and all of your listeners worldwide. You do such a great job, and I appreciate the opportunity to be back with you. You know, the question you ask is the key one right off the top. What are the options available? Those options have narrowed because the Maduro regime has captured now every institution of the state and brought it fully under its control, which means that we are now dealing with a consolidated dictatorship. Any sense of democracy that Venezuela once had has now been extinguished by this fraudulent electoral process from December 6th. That's a real tragedy. Venezuela at one point was Latin America's wealthiest nation. It was also a vibrant, if imperfect, democracy, and now neither of those statements is true. At the same time, it has birthed the worst worst humanitarian crisis in Latin America's modern history, with almost 20% of Venezuela's entire population outside of the country as refugees, according to some estimates. So we have a collapsing society. And meanwhile, the de facto executive is working to try to further strengthen his own rule in the country. So that's the basis from which now the international community is faced with trying to determine what the next steps might be. They face a decision. Will they essentially learn to live with a consolidated dictatorship in the Western Hemisphere, or will they work together diligently and with purpose to try to find a way back to the democratic path in Venezuela? It's a real conundrum.
Well said, Eric Farnsworth, reminding us of the once rich and very strong and stable democracy that Venezuela used to be before Maduro. And now we're facing, as you say, a conundrum. Reinberg, what is your take on the options that the international community has, and will they act in a unified manner?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Carol. And I agree quite a bit with what Eric said. The options were limited before the 6th December election, and now they've been constricted even further. This is a particularly enervating moment, I think, in this struggle. I would define it as a true stalemate on the domestic level. The opposition is truly exhausted, and that is something that's definitely going to further limit policy options for the incoming Biden administration as well, because many of the policy options on the table for the Biden administration and the international community do rely to a certain extent on having a vibrant opposition on the ground in the country that can keep up the pressure. And right now, Venezuela's notoriously fragmented opposition has been showing signs of fractures. It was showing signs of fractures even before the election. It seems to be doing so again now that the election is over. And so as Eric said, there's the consolidation of really a full-blown dictatorship in Venezuela with few vestiges remaining to its deep democratic past. In terms of the solutions, I mean, look, thus far, the United States has embarked on a campaign of sanctions, economic sanctions against both individuals and entities and broad sectors in Venezuela. And I think we have to understand what the purpose of those sanctions are. They're not really representative of an entire diplomatic strategy. They're more like a tactic, part of a broader diplomatic strategy comprised of tools used to promote a political transition, but also measures that are used to reduce the Maduro regime's resources to fund its repressive machinery and to contribute to these unfathomable human rights abuses that we've heard about. And I think the real challenge for the Biden administration will be linking its preference for slowly lifting some of these sanctions and coming to some sort of negotiated political agreement in exchange for some sort of return to the semblance of democracy without squandering any of that leverage. Because make no mistake, the Biden administration will be inheriting a bit of leverage in this situation. And it needs to recalibrate those sanctions if it wants to pursue negotiations with the Maduro regime. But it will be very important to improve them as a tool in a broader diplomatic strategy, while also trying to reduce some of the impact, as Eric mentioned, on Venezuela's very grave unfolding humanitarian emergency.
That's a very good point that you bring up, Ryan, the role of sanctions. So over to you, Eric Farnsworth, to talk about what sanctions are in place, and is it just the United States who has imposed them, and to what extent do they hurt ordinary Venezuelans more than they help the cause of weakening Maduro, and how can they be perhaps leveraged in the future to try to negotiate with the regime?
Yeah, sanctions are one of the tools that are being applied, certainly. And the word tool, I think that Ryan used, is exactly right, because with broad application, they're intended to be ways to build leverage to encourage the regime to change path, change course, to restore the democratic path. There are sanctions levied against any number of individuals in Venezuela, including the president and much of the leadership of the de facto regime. Some of those sanctions are for things like human rights abuses, drug trafficking, things that would be difficult to lift once they're applied. But having said that, smart people can figure out ways to use incentives for lifting sanctions or offering to trade various things for concrete steps toward democracy in Venezuela. That's a risky path, but to this point, nothing else has seemed to work in the context of getting Mr. Maduro to recognize that his time as leader of Venezuela is up. But there are other sanctions as well, particularly in the energy sector, which were levied at the beginning of the year 2019 when Juan Guaido became the interim president of Venezuela, according to Venezuela's own constitution. Constitution back about 20 years ago. And so those sanctions make it far more difficult for Venezuela to monetize its crude oil on the international economy and raise the costs considerably for their ability to do that, which obviously reduces the flow of hard currency to the regime. But we have to hasten to say that most of the destruction of Venezuela's energy sector has come at the hands of Maduro itself. The production, the output has been dramatically declining because of mismanagement, brain drain of managers who have left the country or been forced out, politicization, massive corruption to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars that should be going to the Venezuelan people that have just been, frankly, stolen by the ruling regime. So you have a real confluence of events here. The problem, Carol, to get to your question is, yeah, it does hurt the Venezuelan people. It hurts them a lot because this is the primary engine of economic well-being in Venezuela, and it's being strangled by the Maduro regime itself and by the international community, which has now made it more difficult to monetize that asset. And it's a really important asset. It's Venezuela's primary asset. But the losers here are the Venezuelan people, because the regime itself finds ways to hold on to the resources it needs for its own well-being, in fact, high living in many cases, as well as the resources necessary to keep the security forces loyal so that they will maintain the regime in control. Obviously, the people without connections to the regime are the ones who lose, and that's what has been directly responsible for the massive outflow of human beings from Venezuela into neighboring countries like Colombia, Brazil, some of the countries in the Caribbean, which frankly just don't have the capacity to absorb millions of desperate Venezuelan citizens. It's a real problem.
Back to you, Ryan Berg. Speaking of external actors, on the other side, how would you characterize the malign role of, let's say, Vladimir Putin's Russia, China, Iran, other adversaries? To what extent are they propping up the Maduro regime? And if there's any way, you know, to exploit or somehow co-opt those actors?
Yeah, that's a great question, Carol. One of the things that they've been able to do most effectively, specifically with the Russians, is help prop up some of these schemes that keep the Maduro regime and its cabal of cronies propped up as they have. So that they've set up a number of schemes to flout our international sanctions architecture, to keep sanctioned Venezuelan crude oil in particular flowing to international markets with agreements that trade sort of upfront loans for payment in kind through the Venezuelan crude later. And those are handled with a payment system that's able to skirt our regulations. And so I think the Russians in this case started their intervention in Venezuela as a very opportunistic, something that was presented to them as an opportunity. They took it. But I think now they're doubling down, using Venezuela, for example, as a platform to be able to project further power throughout the hemisphere. And so we've seen not just help in the illicit financial sector, but we've seen a number of military-to-military ties growing in the Russian case. And so I believe it was last year that there were two nuclear-capable bombers that were flown from Russia to Caracas. There's been some talk as well about arms purchases. Venezuela's purchased quite a bit of arms from Russia in the past. There's also been talk of stationing missiles, quite incendiary talk, of stationing missiles on a couple of the islands that Venezuela maintains in the Caribbean and pointing them. We can only guess where. But China and Iran are certainly active as well in the financial space, similar spaces as the Russians. And with Iran, I would say it's also growing military-to-military ties too. And so these external actors have allowed some of the pressure to be relieved on the Maduro regime. They've created the impression that it's perhaps not as much of a pariah state as it actually is. And they've really thrown an important, crucial lifeline to the Maduro regime as its sources of illicit finance dry up in international markets.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the America Society, and Ryan Berg, from whom you just heard, research fellow specializing in Latin America. He's with the American Enterprise Institute. And they both join me via Microsoft Teams. We are discussing the fallout from the recent Venezuelan elections that solidify for now Maduro's grip on power. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Sheha Belden Hamid from Khartoum, Sudan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our show and our conversation about the fallout from the fraudulent Venezuelan elections. So first to you again, Eric Farnsworth. Let's talk a bit more about the opposition. Ryan Berg alluded to some fissures. How would you characterize the opposition? Is Juan Guaido still popular? What are their prospects for trying to push back?
Well, I think it's a challenge. There's no question about it. I mean, you have the term of the current National Assembly ending in the beginning of January, and the whole exercise that we just went through, or the Venezuelans just went through, was designed specifically to delegitimize interim President Guaido. He wasn't allowed to run in the elections, among other things, but with his institutional base, the National Assembly now turning over, you know, that takes that away. So there's a real constitutional question as to who is the interim president. The status of Maduro has not changed. He is still somebody who has usurped the presidency based on clearly fraudulent elections from 2018, and that status has not changed. The question that would be asked is, who is the legitimate interim president? The United States has said that it will continue to recognize Juan Guaido, as have almost 60 other nations around the world. So that is going to be something that will have to be tested going forward. And yeah, there are different factions within the opposition, that's absolutely true. But the one thing that never gets discussed is the advantages that the Maduro regime has to try to divide the opposition. And the 100% effort that they have made since the last National Assembly elections in 2015 to build divisions within the opposition, to divide, to conquer, to favor certain legislators and disfavor others, to put some in prison and exile others, and frankly pay money to some, you know, others. So, you know, they have a lot of tools at their disposal to try to divide the opposition, and goodness knows they've been using them. So, yes, there are divisions, but to lay this all at the feet of the opposition, I think, is just not fair. The Maduro regime is actively trying to do whatever it can to, frankly, delegitimize and disfavor the legitimate representatives of the Venezuelan people. So I think that's where the spotlight should be shone. And once we see it in its proper light, then we come to a different conclusion.
Turning to you, Ryan Berg, for your take on the opposition and the fact that Maduro, as Eric Farnsworth said, tries to divide them purposely, but nonetheless, what about those cracks and differences? To what extent is that going to be an impediment going forward?
Well, I think it's a huge impediment to their operating together in unity and in showing the Venezuelan people that there is a legitimate alternative to the Maduro regime. I think one of the major things that has turned the Venezuelan people on the opposition in the past is when the opposition does some of the self-same things as the Maduro regime, in this case, you know, engages in occasional acts of corruption or internal fissures, as you mentioned. It just shows that they're unable to sort of operate in unison and present the Venezuelan people with a viable alternative. One thing that's quite important to note that I want to add to what Eric said was that before this election, the heads of all four major opposition parties were forced out by Maduro's Supreme Court out of leadership before the election and replaced with regime cronies. And so even though there were some members of the quote-unquote opposition who won their seats in the National Assembly, and so to the outside observer, it might appear as though there is actually a presence of opposition parties in the National Assembly, it's really anything but. And so what you have here is a National Assembly where 253 of the 277 seats are controlled by the United Socialist Party, Maduro's party, and the rest are a sort of scattering of smaller opposition parties where leaders were forced out of their leadership and replaced with collaborators for the Maduro regime.
Back to you, Eric Farnsworth. As you initially said, it's truly a conundrum, and it's going to be very difficult for incoming President-elect Biden to deal with this. He's got a lot on his plate. But what would you recommend to the Biden administration insofar as the United States is a very important player in the hemisphere and could play an important role in leading the group of democracies to try to thwart Maduro and his attempt to muscle his way in to permanent power? How do you see the challenge and the political will there, not only for Biden, but for the entire community of democracies that are still supporting the opposition.
Well, you're exactly right. And I think the first thing we have to remember is we need friends and allies on the ground in the region, particularly Brazil and Colombia, but also Guyana, the countries in the Caribbean, others that border Venezuela, as well as those others that don't perhaps immediately border the country, because they're the ones who are being most directly affected by these migration flows, which are destabilizing in and of themselves. So I think that's the first thing we have to remember. So as we're talking to countries like Colombia, for example, about bilateral issues, which undoubtedly the Biden administration will be doing, we will also be seeking their support, with Venezuelan issues. So there's definitely a balance, I think, that needs to be struck there. I think that's the first point. The second point is don't give up the leverage that currently exists. I mean, the Trump administration built an architecture of sanctions and other things to try to pressure the Maduro regime. Now, it's quite true the Maduro regime remains in power, but just dismantling sanctions, for example, just to do it, I think would be a mistake, although I hasten to say that I don't think anybody in the Biden camp is suggesting that that be done, simply to say that sanctions should be utilized as a way to get to the ultimate goal. And the ultimate goal is free and fair elections that will bring democracy back to a country that's starved for it. And then I think the other thing that the administration could do is to make sure that this is not about the United States, it's about Venezuela, and that the spotlight should be kept on Caracas and the abuses of the Maduro regime. And one way to do that is to work more closely with the International Criminal Court, which is right now trying to decide, do they allegations that the Organization of American States has come up with that accuse Venezuela, the regime, of human rights abuses and crimes against humanity. So this is a very serious charge, and it does need to be pursued. Of course, the United States is hampered somewhat in that the U.S. isn't a member of the ICC, but there are certainly ways to move forward in that forum as well. So there are things that should be considered, but at the end of the day, it's really got to be Mr. Maduro and those around him who decide that their time is up and that they really need to find a different line of work.
Over to you, Ryan Berg, for your take on how the incoming Biden administration should deal with Venezuela. And just like with Cuba, it's almost a domestic political issue because of Venezuelan refugees in Florida. So we have many, many incentives aside from the one that we all know, the importance of restoring democracy and human rights to that country. Also, I'd like you to address the role of OAS, but also, are there any outliers in Latin America with respect to Venezuela, except for, of course, Cuba? What other countries are not, you know, on board in terms of opposing Maduro's actions?
Thank you, Carol. I will add to Eric's long to-do list for the incoming Biden administration on Venezuela policy more diplomacy. As I mentioned before, sanctions are only a tool in a broader diplomatic strategy. And so many of us who have been observing the architecture of sanctions being erected around the Venezuelan regime have always sort of wondered, sanctions and the Biden administration is going to have to fill in that blank. I think that Eric did a great job laying out some of the things that they should do. One thing that I will add to his list is more diplomacy with the European Union. The European Union, for whatever reason, has only decided to place about 20 individual sanctions on folks in and around the Maduro regime, whereas the United States has well over 200. For a union such as the EU, a bloc of countries that considers itself, just like the United States, to be a beacon of democracy concerned with the fate of human rights in the world, I think it's in the EU's interest to step up on Venezuela policy, to come closer in line with the United States, to play an integral role in finding a constructive political solution to Venezuela's crisis. I think, generally speaking, some of the fragmentation in the transatlantic relationship, quite frankly, has gotten in the way of better EU policy toward Venezuela. And so things like the Trump administration's move away from the JCPOA or the Iran deal, the Paris Climate Accords, the constant berating over defense spending, inability to endorse NATO Article 5. Some of these things, I think, have gotten in the way of the EU seeing that it has quite a common interest with the United States in Venezuela. And so I think one of the biggest opportunities for the Biden administration is to revamp EU policy toward Venezuela. In terms of our regional partners, you can look at the most recently passed OAS resolution and see some of the countries that either voted against it or abstained. The two countries that voted against it were Bolivia and Mexico, and quite a few countries abstained, six countries, I believe, countries mostly in the Caribbean who have benefited from economic development programs, mostly cheap oil, from a Chavez-era program called Petrocaribe. And so these are some of the countries where Venezuela and Venezuela issues still have a lot of importance, and these countries tend to abstain in these kinds of votes in the OAS plenary body.
Gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to continue this conversation in the year ahead, because that's all the time we have on this Latin American edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Americas Society and the Council of the Americas, and Ryan Berg, Research Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Dr. Jill Robbins tells us ways to inspect our own writing. Brian Lin talks about a new type of meat and how Singapore has approved its sale. I will return with this week's words and their stories. I will explain the expression carrot and stick approach. Finally, we end our 30 minutes together with the making of a nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, here is Dr. Jill Robbins with the education report.
Recently, someone asked us, "Can you please tell me who is the highest authority or is the most respected resource regarding writing rules?" There are several excellent sources on writing rules. However, the rules are different for different fields, such as business, technology, government, or academic writing. Full-time writers often turn to a handbook, such as Strunk and White's The Elements of Style. This book, published in 1959, combined the earlier work of William Strunk Jr. and E.B. White, the writer of several popular children's books. The Elements of Style has simple rules for good writing. You can get the 1920 version of the book free on Project Gutenberg. More recent versions deal with issues of gender and changes in punctuation. Students writing a report for school may use a book like the Chicago Manual of Style from the University of Chicago. The Chicago Manual deals with English grammar and how to prepare an academic paper. It was first published in 1906. Kate L. Turabian's Manual for Writers of Research Papers, Theses and Dissertations is based on the Chicago Manual. Her work is especially helpful for high school and college students. It is available free online. An excellent place to look for help with writing is Purdue University's Online Writing Lab, or OWL for short. As noted earlier, technical and professional writing is different from what teachers expect of writing in school. So Purdue OWL has a guide for writing business letters and technical materials. The OWL has helpful resources for writing teachers who are working remotely, too. Teachers can download presentations on many subjects related to writing. Another English learner asked us how to avoid plagiarism when writing. Plagiarism is when someone takes another person's work and passes it off as their own. Many schools punish students severely for copying the words of another writer. For those learning English, writing has different problems, and to help them, the OWL has one part especially for ESL students. It includes an explanation of how American schools deal with plagiarism. When students find information on the Internet, it is too easy to copy it and put it directly into their own written work. To avoid this, the OWL urges you to take more time to deeply understand what you read. Begin by looking at books and printed materials before turning to the Internet. When you find information on the Internet, write down notes by hand in a notebook. As you write, put the ideas into your own words. This process is called paraphrasing. Think about the meaning of the whole work. You want to tell your reader how this information is related to your own ideas. If you use another writer's exact words, make sure to place quotation marks before and after them. And tell your reader how to find the original source. The guides I named earlier in this report explain how to quote work in different styles of writing. If you are not sure about how well you paraphrased another writer's work, there are online tools that will tell you how closely your work resembles that of someone else. Ask your school which tool they suggest. Or you can take a few lines from your written work and copy them into an internet search engine. If they are the same as another published work, the search result will probably identify that work. Another good way to test your writing is to read it aloud and see if it is easy to understand. Ask a friend or a family member to listen as you read it and tell you if they can understand. Writing well is not easy, but when finished, you will have a good feeling. You have communicated your ideas to others clearly. I'm Jill Robbins.
Next, Brian Lin brings us a food science story.
Singapore's government has approved the sale of a laboratory-grown chicken meat. The American company that invented the product, Eat Just, says it is the first time lab-grown meat has received such approval anywhere in the world. Lab-grown meat, also called clean or cultured meat, is created from animal cells in a laboratory. The product is made without harming animals. The cells grow directly into the meat outside of any animal. The Eat Just product is to be sold as small pieces, called nuggets. The product is set to launch at a Singapore restaurant in the very near term, the company's CEO, Josh Tetrick, told Reuters news agency. Singapore is an island city-state of 5.7 million people. Demand for alternatives to animal meat is rising across the world, because of public concerns about health, animal welfare, and the environment. Plant-based products, popularized by companies like Beyond Meat, Impossible Foods, and Corn, are selling in a growing number of stores and restaurants. But the development of lab-grown meat has been much slower than that of plant-based versions. The main reason for the delay is money. Lab-grown meat costs a lot more to produce. Tetrick said the San Francisco-based company is also seeking approvals from U.S. government agencies. But he added that Singapore was a good bit ahead of the United States. The Singapore Food Agency said it examined data from processing, manufacturing control, and safety testing before approving Eat Just sales. Tetrick said it is likely that the U.S. and countries in Europe and elsewhere will examine Singapore's approval system and will attempt to create a similar process. Eat Just said it will manufacture the product in Singapore. The company also plans to start making a plant-based egg substitute there that it is already selling in the United States. Eat Just was founded in 2011 and has raised more than $300 million, Tetrick said. The company is valued at around $1.2 billion. Worldwide, more than 24 companies are testing lab-grown fish, cow, and chicken meat. They are hoping to break into a new part of the alternative meat market. Financial experts at Barclays Bank have estimated the market could be worth up to $140 billion by 2029. Competitors in the market have also been able to raise large amounts of money and win support from well-known investors. U.S.-based Memphis Meats raised money this year in a deal led by Japan's SoftBank Group and Singapore-based Temasek. Among the Memphis Meats investors are Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and Virgin Group chief Richard Branson. In Singapore, Shiok Meats aims to become the first company to sell lab-grown shrimp. The company is backed by Harry Sosanto of the Philippines' Mondnisin Corporation, which also owns Corn. I'm Brian Lynn.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. There are many ways to get people to do what you want. You can threaten them with punishment. You can also entice others with a reward. In other words, they will get something in return for some effort or service. Naturally, you can also just ask nicely. But for now, we will talk about threatening and enticing, two effective but different methods of persuasion. First, let's talk about these important words. When we persuade someone, we try to make them do something. We can entice them or offer them something very desirable. We can also make threats or promise harm. Sometimes we do both. One way of saying this is what we call the carrot and stick approach. You can say it is a method of persuasion that involves both a reward and punishment. When given a choice, most people will surely take the carrot, a popular vegetable, instead of the stick, which could hurt. For example, let's say a company has a carrot and stick approach to vacation days. They entice people to work hard by giving lots of time for paid vacations. That is the carrot. But they also threaten to take away those hours if employees refuse to work hard. That is the punishment, or stick. When we say stick, we don't mean giving a stick, we mean hitting with a stick. This kind of system may work well for some workers, but not for others. It depends on what motivates you. Do you like your work? In addition to getting paid, what satisfaction do you get from the job? Or are you only working for a paycheck? When using the carrot and stick method, it is also important to carefully consider the reward and punishment. If you do not want the carrot, you are not going to be motivated to do the work. Also, if the punishment is meaningless to you, it will not motivate you either. Many word historians say the origin of the expression carrot and stick approach is unclear. But some say it comes from the custom of urging a donkey to move forward by hanging a carrot in front of it. If it refuses to move, the caretaker might decide to hit the animal with a stick. Here is another example. The parents tried using a carrot and stick approach with their teenage daughter. They promised her a new phone if she brought up her grades, and threatened to take away her current phone if her grades dropped even lower. When it comes to learning English, a carrot and stick approach is not a good motivational tool. We here at VOA Learning English can only reward you with praise, and we promise not to punish you, nor would we want to. So I think the only thing we are giving out here is carrots. And that's Words and Their Stories for this week. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Ulysses Grant was elected President of the United States in 1868. Grant was a military hero. He led Union troops of the North to victory over Confederate troops of the South in the Civil War. Grant was extremely popular, but he was a much better general than he was a politician. As president, it was not long before he got into trouble in the battles of politics and government. Larry West and Frank Oliver talk about the first term of President Ulysses Grant.
Grant resigned from the army to run for president. However, he ran on his record as a winning general. "Let us have peace," he often said, and the people believed he would guarantee peace. In fact, Grant guaranteed nothing. As a presidential candidate, he offered no new national programs. So, as president, he had no new policies to carry out. He had few struggles with Congress, because he rarely asked Congress to do anything. Many events took place during Grant's two administrations, but he usually was not involved directly. He had problems only because he was linked indirectly to the men who were responsible.
One of President Grant's first problems was caused by two of his friends. They tried to take control of the gold market. The men were Jay Gould and James Fisk. Both were extremely rich. Gould and Fisk developed a plan to buy a large part of the nation's gold supply when the price was low. They would hold the gold until demand greatly increased the price. Then they would sell it and make a lot of money. To be successful, they had to prevent the government from selling gold on the market. Government sales of gold would keep the price down. So Gould and Fisk urged President Grant to stop the Treasury Department from selling gold. Grant refused to give them a firm promise.
The two men brought one of Grant's relatives into their plan. They paid him to write a letter to the president. It asked the president to halt government sales of gold. A messenger took the letter to the White House. He then sent a telegram to James Fisk saying the letter had been delivered. The telegram said, "Letter delivered. All right." Fisk thought this meant that President Grant had agreed to halt government sales of gold. So he began buying gold in huge amounts. Fisk was wrong. The words "all right" meant only that the letter had been delivered. They did not mean that Grant had agreed to the plan. In fact, Grant did not agree. He ordered the Treasury Department to sell gold to block the attempt by Gould and Fisk to control the gold market.
The result was that James Fisk and Jay Gould lost a great amount of money. So did other businessmen and bankers. Many Americans blamed President Grant for not acting quickly enough to stop the activity of his two friends. Concern about Grant grew after another incident was reported at the New York Customs Office. Two of Grant's friends there became involved in a plan to get money from importers. They used their official positions to earn huge amounts of money.
Grant also was criticized for one of his few independent actions as president. He tried to buy the Dominican Republic in the Caribbean. The island nation was ruled by a dictator, Buenaventura Báez. Báez was so dishonest that the people of the Dominican Republic were ready to overthrow him. Before this could happen, he offered to sell his country to the United States. When Grant received the offer, he sent a White House official to negotiate with Báez. The official returned with a treaty giving the Dominican Republic to the United States for $1.5 million. Grant immediately sent American warships to the Dominican Republic. He wanted to keep Báez in power until the treaty was completed. Grant asked the Senate to approve the treaty. Many senators opposed it. They said taking control of the Dominican Republic would cost too much money. They also said it was a bad idea for the United States to take control of any nation in the Caribbean. President Grant went to the Capitol building himself to urge senators to approve the treaty. His efforts failed. The treaty was defeated.
Grant's biggest national problem was the political situation in the former rebel states of the South. After the Civil War, most Southern states were governed by radical members of the Republican Party. Radicals supported citizenship rights and voting rights for blacks. In the late 1860s, the radicals began to lose power. Many failed to be reelected to state office. They were being defeated by candidates of the Democratic Party. Democrats did not want blacks to have any rights at all.
The first radical Republicans to lose power were those in Virginia. The change there was made peacefully. Not so in other Southern states. In Tennessee, Georgia, and North Carolina, Democrats used threats and violence to win elections. Their campaigns often were led by members of the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan was a secret organization of white men. Members believed white people were greater than black people. Wearing cloths over their faces, Klansmen broke up radical Republican political meetings. They threatened, beat, and killed blacks to keep them out of politics. They did the same thing to whites who tried to organize or help blacks.
Before long, Ku Klux Klan groups were formed in every Southern state. By 1871, radical Republican congressmen were demanding a new law to destroy the Ku Klux Klan. A committee headed by radicals was named to investigate Klan activities in the South. The committee heard reports of the Klan's brutal acts. It helped prepare a bill to control the Klan. After much debate, Congress passed the bill. The new law gave the president power to declare military rule in the South. Democrats charged that the real purpose of the law was to keep radical Republican state governments in power. President Grant did not wait long to use his powers under the new law. He declared military rule in a large area of South Carolina. Thousands of people there were arrested. They were tried in federal courts. Juries were made up mainly of blacks and radical whites.
This kind of justice made Southerners feel even more bitterness toward the North. It also angered a number of moderate members of the Republican Party. They said the federal government should not help radical Republicans stay in power in the South. Some of these moderate Republicans broke away from President Grant and the radicals. They called themselves liberal Republicans and formed a new political party. They held their own presidential nominating convention for the election of 1872. They nominated Horace Greeley as their candidate. Greeley published the New York Tribune newspaper.
Democrats believed their only chance to win the election was to support the new liberal Republicans. So they, too, chose Horace Greeley as their presidential candidate. As expected, the radicals who controlled the main Republican Party nominated Grant for a second term. The campaign between Grant and Greeley was very strange. Grant made no speeches. He spent the summer at a holiday town on the Atlantic Ocean coast. His supporters, however, were not silent. They called Greeley a fool and a traitor. They refused to treat him as a serious candidate. Unlike Grant, Greeley did campaign hard, but he had little financial help. He also was hurt by a poorly organized campaign.
On Election Day in 1872, Ulysses Grant won a big victory. He got the votes of 31 of the 37 states. Horace Greeley died 3 weeks after the election. The new Liberal Republican Party died with him. Ulysses Grant and the Radical Republicans would govern for another 4 years.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.